Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so that's what we look at on this show. We talk about what it means to make that a reality. I share some tips and tricks, yes, but also frameworks and blueprints and stories and some of my big epic fails that I've made along the way. So welcome. I just want to start out by saying I have been a bit absent from this podcast lately and a bit absent from blogging for a while. And it's because I spent about 3 weeks focusing on writing my fourth and fifth chapters of my dissertation. And I was doing that while I was also going out and speaking. And I was doing that while I was, of course, still teaching full time at a university. So that's what I've been up to. And I mention this because one of the things I love about doing a dissertation has been the deep dive into theory. Although I knew the research on project-based learning and inquiry-based learning, I never really thought that deeply about motivation and self-efficacy, which is a big part of my dissertation topic. If anything, I had, I think, kind of a simplified idea of self-efficacy, and I thought it was, you know, the belief that you can accomplish something, while motivation was the desire to accomplish something. And it's not that these definitions were wrong. There's actually a strong element of truth to that. But it's actually that it's much, much more complicated. I hadn't considered the role of unidimensional factors like grit or growth mindset or flow theory. And I really hadn't thought much about the interchange between efficacy and motivation. In other words, I had this very oversimplified view of human motivation. I think when I was in the classroom, I had I basically broke motivation into extrinsic motivation and intrinsic motivation. And if you were internally driven, if you were doing something from yourself, that was intrinsic motivation. But if you were doing it for a reward or a punishment or compliance, that was external motivation. But the reality is it is much, much more complicated. One of the things I learned as I really started to do a deep dive into it is this idea of self-determination theory, and this idea that motivation exists on a continuum, and you can kind of think of it as a continuum of autonomy. And on one side, you have controlled motivation, and the other side, you have autonomous motivation. And from there, you have, you know, a motivation where you completely lack motivation. Then you have external regulation, which is often what we think of as extrinsic motivation, as being motivated by rewards, punishment, compliance, things like that. Introjection, which is all about ego involvement, approval, avoiding guilt. Identification or identified regulation that starts getting more, internal, which is personal importance, valuing the activity, goal attainment, attaining some kind of outcome that you're going for. And then integration, which is sort of like a synthesis between what you're doing and who you are. You're internally regulating it. But those are all actually extrinsic motivation, right? Intrinsic motivation is really that you're doing something for the sheer enjoyment of it, for the interest, the satisfaction you feel, the enjoyment of it. And I think a lot of times when we say, I'm intrinsically motivated, we're actually motivated by a sense of identification or identified regulation, right? It fits my values. It's what I care about. It's accomplishing some greater task. I'm making a difference, that kind of stuff. And I mention all of this not because, you know, that's not the topic of today's podcast, but really it's this idea that I didn't understand that theory existed or motivation existed on a continuum. And I really didn't understand the complexity of motivation. And I had created these two false binaries between extrinsic being bad and intrinsic being good. And the reality is it is so much more complicated. Now, why does this matter? It's just theory, right? Well, diving into self-efficacy and self-determination has been humbling. I'm learning how much I don't know about human motivation, which in turn allows me to be more nuanced when I talk to people about it. Also, understanding that these ideas are task-specific has helped me understand the role of both self-efficacy and motivation in my creative work. Now, here's what I mean. If you think about that continuum that I mentioned, I can now see it happening all the time in my creative work. I might be, let's say I'm doing a sketch video. I might love and enjoy the process of making a sketch video. That is, you know, intrinsic motivation. I love doing it, but it also fits who I am, and it starts getting into the, you know, this idea of fitting my talents and integration. But chances are what I'm creating is coming from a sense of a purpose. I want to teach someone something. I want to accomplish a goal. And I have this element of identified regulation. But there's also an element of work where I want people's approval. All creative work I do, I want to avoid being embarrassed, or I want to seek other people's approval, or I want people to like me. And that's introjection, right? And then, of course, I'm going to care about the numbers. I'm going to care about, you know, subscribers and things like that, even though I don't want to. And that's external regulation. Now, I kind of frame those as negative, but the truth is, this happens all the time in what I do, right? I set up little, when I was working on my dissertation, I loved geeking out on the topic. That was intrinsic motivation, just the fun of that. Integration began to happen as I would do the research and fit in with this sort of consistency of how I identify as a professor and a thinker and a learner. And then identification, I wanted what I work on to contribute to the field of education. But also there were days I just didn't feel like working on it. And introjection is what motivated me. It was a sense that I'll feel guilty about not doing this task today if I don't do it, right? And guilt avoidance drove me to work harder. Or I cared about my, you know, what my dissertation chair would think. And then external regulation. I set up little rewards for myself when I had tasks that I hate doing, the boring, monotonous APA format. The bottom line is I'm learning that, you know, motivation isn't about good and bad. It's about what works and when and how those things work. Instead of seeing these as good or bad, I'm really seeing this as motivation is more or less autonomous and thinking strategically about the best way to use it. Now I get it. It's just theory. But knowing this theory has given me a deeper level of understanding of the creative work I do. And it's helping me, I think, become a better teacher as a result. Now, I mention this because when I first started teaching, I was really dismissive about educational theory. It felt cold and calculated and overly scientific. For me, teaching was an art, and it was something that you move through intuitively. You feel your way through the teaching process. But then I read this piece from Neil Postman, who's one of my favorite thinkers on language and technology, and he wrote about the metaphors of language. And I began to read up on something called conceptual metaphor theory, and I realized that language I was using implied that teaching was a messy art, while theory was cold and distant science. And I mention this because conceptual metaphor theory says that in any given conversation, the language you use points to an implied metaphor. By studying this, you have a framework for understanding everyday language. I'm going to give a small example. If someone says, wow, things are escalating, or you shot down my idea, or don't get so defensive, when they start using that in a conversation, you can recognize the implied metaphor that discussion, conversations have become a battle. And a fight is exactly that. It's a battle metaphor. And why this matters is, when I see people using fighting language or battle language or war language in the midst of a conversation, it almost always tells me that things have gotten too combative. And again, I just used, right, combative, same thing. And that I should use my language to de-escalate. So it's actually incredibly practical for me. Now, I began to realize at that point that theory isn't simply something you study abstractly. It's actually something that you use. Theory provides us with a foundation for practical knowledge and a lens for making sense out of our world. And with that in mind, I want to share 7 reasons why teachers might want to explore educational theory. Number 1, theory provides a foundation for practical information. Theory is all around us if we're paying attention. Theories are the things that answer the big why questions that then drive the how. Our theories help us make sense out of how things work in our world. They provide us with evidence, and you see it everywhere all around you. For example, I love UX design theory, and it is eminently practical. By understanding UX design, you have a framework that you can use as you design your classroom space or you design your classroom materials, things like that. If you're an author, you probably follow certain theories for StoryCraft without even realizing it. If you're an engineer, your work is rooted in specific scientific theories that are tested and retested. In other words, theory is a part of both the art and science of the work that we do. And theory is that foundation for our craft. On a practical level, theories often provide us with these frameworks and models that we can use as we create something new. For example, I love Schlechte's levels of engagement. It's a visual that shows what high attention and high commitment looks like, all the way down to low attention and low commitment. And I have used that several times as a framework to make sense out of the students in my class and to ask, are they really engaged in the learning, or are they just strategically compliant, which is where they are focused, but they are not truly committed to the tasks? So that's idea number one, is that theory provides a foundation for our practical information. Idea number two is that theory provides nuance. And I think this is important. We often have these false binaries in education, right? Homework is bad or homework is good. This is bad, that is good. And what it does is when we really take a deep dive into theory, we realize that it's complicated and nuanced. And I think that's important. You know, we see that learning should be based on direct instruction or inquiry. How about both, right? Motivation should be intrinsic or extrinsic. Actually, it's on a continuum, right? The more we understand this, the better we are at being truly nuanced. Now, I want to say that nuance isn't the same as a compromise or finding the middle. It's about understanding the complexity and being okay with the paradoxical nature of truth. It's about asking, when is this true, rather than just saying, is this true? And ultimately, that process humbles us, which leads to point number three, theory humbles us. The more you immerse yourself in theory, the more painfully aware you are of how much you don't understand. You begin to realize that people who have devoted their entire lives into researching certain truths and sharing that with the world, and that those people often left with bigger questions unanswered, and that's okay. There's this very humbling aspect to it. Right now, I feel like I understand motivation and efficacy so much better than I did before, but I am painfully aware of what I don't know. I think when we come to terms with what we don't know, we avoid making those bold, ignorant pronouncements about education. It keeps us from saying those, you know, trite, tweet-worthy things that people post on social media. Often it becomes something where we are more open to new ideas, which actually makes us more curious about how learning works, which then allows us to do better research ourselves. The bottom line is, again, that's the big idea, is theory will humble us. Number four, theory reminds us that ideas happen in community. This is the idea that every theory exists as part of a community of scholars who have studied it. And scholars are often practitioners. They're often people who are still in the classroom. But it's the idea that when we think about our favorite theories, we tend to kind of focus on the big names, right? Self-efficacy is Bandura, right? Or Desi and Ryan are self-determination theory, or you know, growth mindset is just, you know, Carol Dweck's idea. But the idea that we actually find is that the more we understand theory, the more we understand that it's a conversation within a community, that it is rooted in a contextual and historical reality, that ideas evolve over time. And that actually allows us to be more critical of theories and to see it as much more nuanced. Number five, theory keeps us from mistaking novelty for innovation. When you take a deep dive into theory, you realize that great ideas endure over time, and that relevance is really not about being flashy and new, it's about being better and different. Now, understanding educational theory helps us avoid the trap of following the latest fads. We are able to see that certain great ideas are actually a little bit older. But it also keeps us from growing curmudgeonly and saying, this is just the latest fad. Consider design thinking. We often think of it as something newer or trendier, but it has a rich history that goes back 60 to 70 years. And understanding that rich history gives us a sense of how ideas evolve over time. And we're able to see how theories adapt to new contexts. And I think that's really powerful because it keeps us from focusing on fleeting novelty. Number six, theory gives us a critical lens. Now, there are a lot of bad ideas in education that somehow seem to persist. For example, there are no right brain or left brain thinkers. We all use both sides of our brain. We don't have learning styles. It's bogus. It doesn't exist. And while this might not seem like a big deal, I've seen language arts teachers who have said things like, I'm not going to make them read a book. Instead, they're going to watch movies because a lot of my students are visual learners. Nope. The truth is we all learn from visuals and we all learn from reading. But that's why we need theory. So we don't fall into those myths and those fads and those fleeting things that just aren't true. Theory provides us with that critical lens for understanding new research as well. For example, my knowledge of behavioral economics allow me to see motivation and self-efficacy in new light. This is why we need theory. All right, finally, number seven, theory gives us evidence for the work that we do. I think it's important that we know why we do what we do. And yes, part of it is observational. Part of it is experiential. Part of it is just doing the work and seeing what works and experimenting. But another part of it is determining what works in what context based on looking at the theoretical framework behind it. It gives us that big foundation of what we're going to do. And I mention all of this because there's often an anti-theory mentality in K-12 education. I see this when pre-service teachers I work with will have a cooperating teacher who says, college classes are just a bunch of theory, but this is where you'll actually learn how to teach, as if theory is somehow divorced from reality. There are other variations of this, including that might work in theory, but a real classroom is different. Now, I understand why this happens. Often, the way we talk about theory is way too abstract. It's presented in a systematic way. It's overly simplified. So with that in mind, I just want to talk and kind of end with this idea of how do we make theory more accessible? I think it starts with making connections between theory and practice and showing it in a way that's more explicit. When we explore a theory, it can help to explore it through a case study or a problem. At times, we might even use strategic confusion to wrestle with the ideas before seeing a particular theory. We should also build in discussion time to talk about how a theory relates to practice. I also think it helps to treat theory as something you use rather than just something you understand. For example, when I share the research on UX design theory with my college students, they also use a self-reflection rubric based on the design principles, the design theory, and then they use it to critique the design of their classroom space, their materials, and their systems. Here they get a chance to see that theory isn't merely an abstract idea, it's something you actually use. It also helps to provide visual models for theories. I think we do a disservice when we oversimplify, but we also have to recognize that we tend to be visual thinkers, all of us. We tend to conceptualize things visually. We visualize them, obviously, and that's how we make sense out of it. So I think it helps to actually critique the visuals as well. So you might look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you ask, what is the danger in presenting something as a hierarchy? What is the danger of presenting something in a pyramid? What are the pros and cons of this? We also need to critique educational theory, which is kind of the idea there. We need to understand that there are great educational theories, but they all have their limitations. For example, I met somebody who was a special ed teacher, and we were talking about universal design for learning, and he said something that really stuck out to me. He said, yes, we want to aim for universal design, but sometimes a disability calls for a specific modification that cannot and should not be available to everyone. We should be asking ourselves when something should be universal and when it should be particular. And as a special ed teacher with multiple sclerosis, he was living the nuances of universal design on a daily basis. And I realized something. It's really important to critique that theory, as good as that theory may be. It's also important that we avoid the temptation to create false binaries. You know, this theory is good or this theory is bad, or motivation is either extrinsic or intrinsic. We really need to talk about how things exist on a spectrum or a continuum, which context they work, which context they don't work in. And again, focusing on what are the, you know, the nuances of the theory and what are the contextual realities of the theory. The final thought is we need better access to educational theory. Look, a lot of us can't read journal articles because we don't have access to journal articles. There's a giant paywall that gets in the way. I think there are things that we can do, though. If you are somebody who is in the classroom and you're busy and you don't have a lot of time, find the places where education theory is accessible without being overly simplified. This is why I love Cult of Pedagogy. Jen Gonzalez does a phenomenal job on her podcast getting into the nuances and complexity of theory while also keeping it, you know, accessible. It's why I love Wikipedia. I love the fact that it will simplify ideas, but not overly simplify ideas. The bottom line is that as educators, we are more empowered when we understand educational theory. It takes time. It takes mental energy, but it is absolutely worth it. Hey, thank you so much for listening. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoyed this podcast, would you leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher? That would mean the world to me. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make some.